I would like to add my hearty welcome to everyone here. We have many visitors with us, and we want you to know that you are honored guests. We have some that are visiting that really aren't visitors, and it's good to see Eric and Whitney, and good to have Bob and Sharon back with us as well this morning. When I was going to graduate school, went to school a lot of years, and I'm always thankful that I was able to do that. But I came to understand that there are not very many really great teachers in this world. And I finally found the criteria that separated the great teachers from just the good teachers. And it was those people that could present some material to me in such a way that as I pondered on it, I would say, why in the world didn't I think of that? It's so obvious. Well, you've seen this before, but Brother John Witt, who was the preacher at the congregation we worshiped at in Florida, came up with this, and this is one of those, why didn't I think of that moments when he first presented this material? And I feel honored that he allowed me to set this up and put it on PowerPoint for him. John is, by the way, the same age as Wilma, 92 years old, so he's not preaching full-time anymore, but he still preaches, and he's just as spry as Wilma is, so it's good to see that. If you remember, we start here at the bottom left-hand corner. A concept is a mental picture of something, and concepts are important because they're the soil from which we draw our conclusions, and our conclusions end up producing our behaviors and our practices. So man behaves or practices or lives according to his concept. And this is true in every realm, whether it's religion that we're talking about now or economics, engineering, or whatever. Many, if not all, of the problems in the religious world today are the result of the fact that people have so many incorrectly held concepts about things. So the concept must be corrected first. And this is exactly what Paul did in Athens. Remember, these people were grossly immoral. And he writes about that immorality in Romans chapter 1. And why were they grossly immoral? It's because they had such a low estimate of deity. So what did Paul do? He didn't directly attack the immoral behavior. He first tried to change their concept of deity. And my sermon this morning, I hope, I'm not going to your concept. It's about Jesus. I'm not trying to change your concept. I'm trying to enhance your concept of who Jesus really is. And the title of the lesson is The Star Breather. And that sounds kind of cryptic and ominous, but hopefully by the end of this sermon, you'll come to a much greater appreciation of what that's all about. You know, the universe exists more than just for a place for us to live. As Todd read from Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God. And as you go on and read that psalm, it's something that should be universally understood, that the heavens declare the glory of God. In Romans 1, Paul wrote about it. And he said, since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. How? Being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. By looking at God's creation, we can understand there is a God, and he possesses eternal power and deity. It's as if there were giant neon signs in the heavens proclaiming there is a God. All you have to do is look at that and come to that understanding. Perhaps you've heard of Carl Sagan. He's dead and gone now, but he was the host of the original Cosmos series on PBS. He was a professor at Cornell University. And he made a statement that I totally agree with, but I don't think he really understood the ramifications of it when he said, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Well, the Bible claims there is a God and that he possesses eternal power and deity. This extraordinary claim is backed up by extraordinary evidence, the universe that he created. Now let's take a look at these things. Let's look, first of all, look at man's place in the universe. Well, we all know we live on the planet Earth, the third rock from the sun. The Earth is a big place. It has a surface area of about 200 million square miles. If you could divide the surface area of the Earth up into 5,408 equal pieces, one piece would be the size of Indiana. If you could divide Indiana into 90 pieces, equal pieces, Monroe County would represent one of those. To give you a better perspective, I'm going to compare it to a golf ball. I don't know if you're a golf fan, but they're having a big tournament up in Carmel. Today is the last day of the BMW Championship. And most of the pros use this golf ball. It's called a Titleist Pro V1. It's 1.68 inches in diameter and has 332 dimples on it. If the Earth were a Titleist Pro V1 ball, then Indiana could be represented by 1/8 of a dimple. That little red dot right there would represent Indiana. And if you could divide that red dot into 90 equal pieces, Monroe County would equal just one piece of that red dot. So now I challenge you, find yourself on that red dot. Merely a speck on a speck on another speck that's on another speck that's in basically invisible. Well, let's turn our attention to the star breather. What do we mean by the star breather? Well, God created every star that we see and every star that we don't see. In Genesis chapter 1, beginning in verse 14, God said, "Let there be lights in the firmament of the heavens to divide the day from the night, and let them be for signs and seasons, for days and years. Let them be for lights in the firmament of the heaven to give light on the earth." And it was so. Then God made two great lights, the greater light to rule the day and the lesser light to rule the night. And this has to be the biggest understatement in the history of history. He made the stars also. I want you to remember that short sentence. He made the stars also. Well, how was it done? Well, he created them by the breath of his mouth. In Psalm chapter 33 and verse 6, "By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all the host of them by the breath of his mouth. He gathers the waters of the sea together as a heap. He lays up the deep in storehouses. Let all that fear the Lord, let all the inhabitants of the world stand in awe of him. For he spake, and it was done. He commanded, and it stood fast." Well, who did this? Jesus was the active member of the Godhead in creation. In John chapter 1, as John opens his gospel, he says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." Of course, he's talking about Jesus Christ. "He was in the beginning with God." Now notice verse 3, "All things were made through him, and without him nothing was made that was made." In Colossians 1 and verse 16 and 17, Paul writes that by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created through him and for him. And he is before all things, and in him all things consist. And then even more amazingly in Hebrews 11 and verse 3, "By faith we understand that the worlds were framed by the word of God, so that the things that are seen were not made of things which are visible." From the power of his breath, Jesus created the material universe out of nothing. He didn't have vast storehouses of hydrogen and oxygen and carbon and so forth from which to draw all these materials and make all of these heavenly bodies. He spoke them into existence from nothing. Try to wrap your head around that. I think about it all the time, and I still can't wrap my head around that completely. It is such an awesome thing to consider. So I've got two thoughts that I want you to hold on to right now. First of all, you and I are just invisible specks on that little red dot. And the heavens declare the glory of God. He created everything from nothing. Well, let's get a better perspective of that. We looked at the earth. The earth is a big place, but the sun is a very big place. It's 93 million miles away from the earth. If you could drive your car to the sun at 70 miles an hour, it'd take you almost 152 years to get there. And that's not taking account of stopping for gas or to use the restroom. That's a long time. And yet we are very close to the sun, relatively speaking, versus the other planets in our solar system. The size of the sun is very big. The radius of the sun is over 430,000 miles. That's 110 times the radius of the Earth. If you could weigh all of the mass of the solar system, the sun, the planets, asteroids, and so forth, the sun would make up 99.86% of that mass. So the Earth, and Jupiter, and Saturn, and all that, we're just 0.14% of the rest. We're this little bit that's left over. It's amazing. The sun burns 683 million tons of fuel per second. Can you imagine that? That's like 18 million fully loaded semis per second being burned. The area of the sun, remember the Earth is about 200 million square miles. The area, surface area of the sun is 6 trillion square miles. It's a hot place too, 10,000 degrees at the surface, over 27 million degrees at the center. The volume of the sun is 3.4 quadrillion cubic miles. I had to look that one up. I didn't know what a quadrillion was. It's 10 to the 15th power. So it's 10 followed by 15 zeros. And the Earth is just a tiny speck. You can see this picture. The Earth, get up here close, is right there. The little bitty spot compared to the sun. But the sun is just an average star. Until 2012, the largest known, and I underscore that, known star was VY Canis Majoris, the great dog star. That's what that means in Latin. Remember, the radius of the sun was 430,000 miles. The radius of Canis Majoris is 614 million miles. It's over 1,400 times the radius of the sun. Its radius is so huge that if you put Canis Majoris where our sun is, the edge of the Canis Majoris would be between Jupiter and Saturn. It would completely engulf all of the inner planets. The circumference of the star is so great that it even takes light 8 years to go around that star. If you could fly around it in a jet airliner, it'd take you over 1,100 years to fly around it. Its volume is 2.7 octillion miles. I had to look that up too. That's 10 to the 27th power. Its volume, you could put 70 quadrillion Earths inside of that star. And you can see it, our sun in comparison there on the slide. You could put 9.3 billion suns inside Canis Majoris. But poor Canis Majoris got knocked out of first place. In 2012, they found an even bigger star called UY Scuti. And that figure at the top shows our sun in comparison to UY Scuddy, our sun pixel, so it doesn't even show in that upper picture. In zooming in 7 times, you can see that the sun is just this little dot down here. UY Scuddy is over 1,700 times the radius of our sun. It's 20% larger than Canis Majoris. If UY Scuddy was the Rose Bowl, our sun would be the size of a lemon. And you can imagine putting that lemon in the Rose Bowl, it just basically disappear. The Earth would be no larger than a small pebble compared to that star. So we've got 3 things to hold on to. You and I are just invisible specks on a red dot. The heavens declare the glory of God because he created them from the breath of his mouth, from nothing. And in comparison to the earth, the sun, and the stars, how big am I? Something to contemplate. But let's look even further into this. Let's look at the size of the observable universe. This is just what man can see. We know how much more is out there, but this is just what we can see. It's unfathomable to think about in terms of scale, that is distances, and in terms of scope, the number of stars. As far as distances are concerned, we have to measure it in terms of light years. Can't just use average run-of-the-mill measurements. Light travels at 186,000 miles per second, about 670 million miles an hour, or almost 6 trillion miles a year. You remember when the astronauts went to the moon, it took them 3.5 days to get there, and they were traveling at thousands of miles an hour. It takes light less than 1.3 seconds to go from the Earth to the moon. The sunshine that you see out there left the sun 8 minutes and 20 seconds ago and has traveled 93 million miles to get here. Remember, it took the car 152 years to get there, and it takes light only a little over 8 minutes. Light could circumnavigate the Earth in 0.13 seconds. We just had the Olympics here recently, and you remember Usain Bolt, amazing runner. He holds the record at 100 meters, 9.58 seconds. In the time it took him to run 100 meters, light can go around the Earth 72 times. That's how fast it is. The closest star to the sun is called Proxima Centauri. It's 4.24 light years. Many of you have been to my house. My house is separated from my neighbor's house by a driveway. Well, think of that picture. That's the relationship between our sun and Alpha Centauri, the closest neighbor. The fastest space vehicle is Voyager 1, which is kind of amazing. It was launched 39 years ago this month. It's whizzing through space at over 38,000 miles an hour. Now, how long do you think it would take it to get to Proxima Centauri? Any guesses? Take it almost 75,000 years to get there. And that's just across the driveway, so to speak. Well, that's some of the scale of the universe. Let's look at the scope of the visible universe. Remember, I'm getting ahead of myself. The diameter is, make sure I'm on the right slide here. The diameter of the known universe is 93 billion light years. Remember, we're just 4.24 light years away from the nearest star, but this observable universe is unimaginable in size. It contains over 100 billion galaxies. A galaxy is a grouping of stars, kind of like a star city. Each galaxy contains 10 million to 10 trillion stars each. There are more stars in the observable universe than there are grains of sand on the entire Earth. and remember how Genesis 1 and verse 16 puts it. He made the stars also. Is that an understatement? That is quite an understatement. Man can only crudely estimate the number of stars, but God knows exactly how many there are. In fact, he's named them all. Psalm 147 and verse 4. He counts the number of the stars. He calls them by name. Well, surely there's some lessons that we can learn from this. You may have heard of the Hubble Space Telescope. It was launched in 1990, and it has really opened up the universe to many new discoveries because it can see so much more than even the most powerful telescopes that are located on Earth, because it doesn't have to look through the atmosphere and have all of that interference. Well, there was this one patch of sky, a really small patch of sky. If you put your arm out like this and you look at the tip of your thumb, this patch of sky would be about the size of the tip of your thumb. And there just wasn't much there. In fact, the telescopes on Earth saw a picture something like this, and the light kind of washes it out, but there were just a few pinpoints of light in that little small region. So they decided to train Hubble to that region, and they took some pictures. And here's what Hubble found. Found that there was a lot more there than we thought. Over two-thirds of these points of light are not individual stars, they're galaxies, entire galaxies. So there are billions and billions of stars in that little space the size of the end of your thumb. In October of 2018, they're going to launch a new space telescope called the James Webb Space Telescope. It's supposed to be 100 times more powerful than Hubble. In fact, it's so powerful, I've read, that if we could set it up in the parking lot here and aim it north, we could read the writing on a football in Spartan Stadium in East Lansing, Michigan. That's how powerful this telescope is. So we've learned a lot with Hubble. We're going to learn even much more with the Webb telescope. But I guarantee you it's probably going to generate as many questions as it provides answers. Well, another lesson to be learned is that man knows much less than he's willing to admit. Much less. I've said this before, one of my favorite programs on television is called How the Universe Works. Even though it drives me crazy and I end up talking to my TV sometimes when I watch that program, I still like to watch it. The thing that bothers me the most is that the scientists that are on it speak as if they have everything figured out about the universe. And if the subject of creation or God ever comes up, then those people are just hopeless dimwits. They're on par with people that believe the earth is flat. Well, I want to talk a little bit about my experience. When I got my PhD, had to do research, and we used all of these statistical tools to analyze the data. And, you know, everybody that does that sort of thing uses those kinds of tools. And we cannot be satisfied in making a solid conclusion unless the error term, as we would call it, was less than 1%. If I had based my conclusions on anything less precise, I would have flunked out of school. I have several articles that are published in scientific journals. So if I'd have sent in an article to be published with less precision, it would have been sent back to me, and at the top in red letters, it'd say rejected. I had the opportunity to speak at several scientific conferences. If I had gotten up with less precision than that and started speaking, they would have turned off the microphone and told me to go home. One of my favorite words is the word hubris, H-U-B-R-I-S. It means excessive pride or self-confidence, arrogance. And to me, that so aptly describes some of the scientists that appear on programs like How the Universe Works. Now, I'm not saying that these folks are not smart. I know they're smarter than I am. They're very intelligent people. But they're not nearly as smart as they would have us believe that they are. And why do I say that? They can only accurately explain less than 5% of the universe. Their error term is over 95%. Less than 5% of the universe is made up of normal matter. We're probably all familiar with the periodic table, all of the elements. Well, only less than 5% of the universe is made up of stuff that's on that chart. The remaining, as one well-known science writer put it, the remainder is, the short answer is, we have no idea. We don't know. You see, these scientists can't explain two things, very important things. Number one, they can't explain why the universe just doesn't fly apart. By all measurements, by all of the things that they understand, the universe should just fly apart. These galaxies should just disintegrate and everything fly apart. Second thing they can't explain is why the universe is expanding at an expanding rate. You remember the theory of the formation of the universe by these people is the Big Bang. That 14.7 billion years ago, there was this infinitely small singularity, they call it, which that right off the bat bothers me. If something's infinitely small, it doesn't exist, does it? Isn't that the very definition of non-existence, infinitely small? But anyway, this singularity exploded. Now think of how an explosion works. If I were to throw a hand grenade out into the parking lot and it exploded, the shrapnel from that hand grenade would fly outward, right? It would initially accelerate, then do what? Then start slowing down, and eventually everything would fall back to the earth. But the universe acts just the opposite. The explosion slowing down, it's increasing at an increasing rate. So to account for this, these have invented, mark that down, these two entities, dark matter and dark energy. I would call these their error terms. This is the error term in their explanation of the universe. According to their current theories, dark matter is what keeps galaxies held together. They can't measure it, they can't see it, but the galaxies are held together, so they're in their mind there has to be something there. Personally, I think the answer is in Colossians 1 and verse 17. Jesus is before, not only the creator, he is before all things. In him, all things do what? Consist. They're held together. He's holding this universe together. At least that's my belief. According to their theories, this accounts for about 27% of the universe. Then this other term, dark energy, is what's pushing the universe outward. And that, according to their theories, accounts for 78%. So dark matter and dark energy are their error terms, their band-aids, if you will, on their theories. One of these scientists put it this way, and he believes in the Big Bang. He says that dark matter and dark energy serve as a scaffolding. You know what a scaffold is? To keep the Big Bang theory from toppling over. And there's much, much more that could be said about problems with the Big Bang theory, but we're not here to study that. So what's my point? The point is simply this. Don't be intimidated by godless, materialistic scientists. They don't know nearly as much as they would have you think that they know. When you watch programs, yes, there's a good deal of science, but there's also a good deal of science fiction in those programs. When you watch those programs, there's a good deal of truth, but there's also a good deal of speculation as well. When I watch those programs, I'm reminded of Psalm 2 and verse 4. It says, "He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision." It makes me think of Job 38. Remember, as Job questioned God, then God turns the tables on Job and he says, "Who is this who darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Now prepare yourself like a man and I will question you, and you shall answer me. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding." Well, another thing that this great universe of ours tells us, it gives us testimony to God's greatness and man's smallness. Remember, VY Canis Majoris could hold 70 quadrillion suns, or Earth's 9.3 billion suns. The observable universe has over 100 billion galaxies with up to 10 trillion stars each. I really had to look these two numbers up. That means there, in the observable universe, there are something like a septillion total stars. That's 10 to the 24th power. But no one really knows except God, because he counts the number of the stars and calls them all by name. And David adds in verse 5, "Great is our Lord and mighty in power. His understanding is infinite." God is great. Man, on the other hand, is small. We're just little tiny invisible specks on that red dot. We're infinitesimally small in comparison to the earth, much less the sun and the universe. Physically, we're insignificant. We're nothing. And to make matters even worse, spiritually, we're even worse off. We're totally spiritually bankrupt. All have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. We're separated from God by sin, and the wages of that is death. As we studied from 2 Thessalonians this morning, when the Lord comes again, he's going to take vengeance on those that know not God and have not obeyed the gospel. Fiery vengeance, eternal vengeance. Matthew 25 and verse 41, without salvation, we're going to go to that place that was prepared for the devil and his angels. But on the other hand, or got ahead of myself, I really like this quote from Isaac Watts. He wrote some of the hymns in our book. He wrote one time that man is in a state of utter lostness, and we need to always keep that in mind. So on one end of the spectrum, we're nothing. We're physically insignificant, totally spiritually bankrupt. But on the other end of the spectrum, we are everything. We are the focal point of God's creation. In Psalm 8, David writes, he noticed this and he wondered. He says, "When I consider your heavens," when I consider this unimaginably large and awesome universe, "the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars, which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him?" What a question to ponder. Think of those stars that we studied, the sun, Canis Majoris, and so forth. Those one septillion stars in the known universe. None of them were created in God's image, but you and I are created in his image. He gives us all things that pertain to life and godliness. He certainly gives them life, but one day they're going to be rolled up like a scroll, said the psalmist, and done away with. So think about the great gifts that God has given us through the star breather, and that's Jesus Christ. But with that comes great responsibility. Will God not hold us accountable for such a vaunted position in this great creation that he has made? Well, This great universe tells us who Jesus really is. Jesus is everything. As Christians, we all know that he's the Son of God. That was the confession that Peter made. Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. That's the proposition on which the church is built. That's what the Ethiopian confessed in order to be saved. He's the Son of God. He is deity, for in him dwells all the fullness of the Godhead bodily. He, according to the Hebrew writer, is the brightness of God's glory and the express image of his person. He's eternal. Remember when he was talking with the Jews, before Abraham was, I am. But he's also the star breather. He's the creator. All things are created through him and by him, and nothing that was made without him. He made everything. He spoke them into existence by the power of his word. Not only that, he counts the number of the stars and calls them all by name. So we need to think about that. What a great, profound fact that is, that Jesus Christ is the star breather. As we think about that, we should better appreciate the enormity of several things. And this is the real point of the lesson. We should appreciate the enormity of recognizing his existence. He didn't create this vast and glorious universe for nothing. It's a message to us. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence, and he's provided it for us. There is a God, and that should motivate us to search him out. In Acts 17, Paul, preaching to the Athenians, said that the God is not far from each of us. We need to be groping for him, and what will happen? We will find him. The vastness of this great universe tells us a lot about his sacrifice. The star breather gave himself for us. As we partook of the elements of the Lord's Supper, the man that was hung on that cross was the star breather that spoke this awesome universe of ours into existence. You know, when you think of the idea of a sacrifice should be proportional in value to what it's being sacrificed for. So that tells us something about how much God values us, doesn't it? As we contemplate these things, it should tell us the enormity of sin. Think of all the riches there are in this world. And you could gather them all in a pile, and they couldn't atone for our sin. Only the star breather sacrifice could do that. I'm amazed as I study the Bible about a lot of things, but especially about the idea of propitiation and reconciliation. Propitiation is the idea that something has to be offered to satisfy the wrath of God. And what did it take? It took the death of the star breather to do that. That should tell us how enormous sin is. We are God's enemies, and in order for that reconciliation to take place required the death of the star breather. Now, those two facts in and of themselves are great facts to consider. But what's even greater to consider is that we didn't offer the propitiation. We didn't initiate the reconciliation. That was all done by God. And that brings us to the next point, the enormity of his grace, love, and mercy. He made the stars also, Genesis 1 and verse 16. What an understatement. But God demonstrates his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. That's quite a statement, but it's still an understatement when we consider who Christ really is. In this is love, John writes, not that we love God, but that he loved us and sent his son to be a propitiation for our sins. This also tells us the enormity of Christ's humility. And we can read about that in Philippians chapter 2. Think of the glory and the awesomeness of a being who can speak this material universe into existence, speak it into existence from nothing. Think of how glorious that being is. And he left all of that and came and lived as a man. You might think this is kind of a weird thought, but I was talking to Sherry about this just yesterday. When we think about the coming of Christ, we know that it was just the right time for him to come. Galatians 4 and verse 4. He came at just the right time. But think about it. Who was it the right time for? Well, it was a right time for God's plan of salvation. It was a right time for the human race. We had been prepared by the law of Moses and the futility of walking without God as far as the Gentiles were concerned for Christ to come. But I got to thinking, boy, this wasn't the right time for Jesus. You know, with his credentials, shouldn't he come at a time when he could have been chauffeured in a limousine, in a motorcade that would rival the motorcade of the president? Shouldn't he have traveled from Galilee to Jerusalem in a jet helicopter, buzzed around with the apostles in a Learjet? He didn't even experience air conditioning and central heat. Think of the food preservation methods in that day and time. How many times those people must have suffered from at least mild forms of food poisoning and all the symptoms that brings. And they, I don't mean to be gross, they didn't even have toilet paper in those days and times. Think about, he walked everywhere he went except the time he rode the donkey. Slept out under the stars that he created. Think of the humility that required. And yet he even went further by dying an unjust death on the cross, the shameful, most painful death possible. I had the good fortune when I was working on my master's degree to study physiology. And I got to thinking as I studied that Jesus knows everything to know in this book that I'm reading, plus a lot more, because he invented all this stuff. So when he was contemplating going to the cross, he knew down to the minutest details how that was going to hurt and the suffering that he was going to go through. So his humility is awesome. And it's a humility that we need to imitate as best we can. Another thing this should tell us is the enormity of the power that's available to us. In Ephesians 1 and verse 19, Paul is praying for the Ephesian Christians, and one of the things that he wants them to know is the exceeding greatness of his power toward us who believe. And he says next that it's according to the working of his mighty power. Think of the power that Jesus has, the star breather. He spoke the material universe into existence. His power has no limits. And that power is available to us. It's available to us as we seek to overcome temptation. Guaranteed that we'll not face one that we can't overcome. God will always provide the way of escape. And to further drive that point home, the star breather came and lived as a man, so he knows exactly what it's like to go through all of these temptations. As we're suffering through trials and tribulations, remember, Paul prayed for the thorn in the flesh to be removed. And what did he say? My grace is sufficient for thee. Think of the power available through the grace of God. The psalmist said in Psalm 55 and verse 22, cast your burden on the Lord, and he shall sustain you. He shall never permit the righteous to be moved. Peter puts it this way in 1 Peter 5 and verse 7, that we can cast all our care upon him, for he cares for us. And what's becoming my favorite psalm is Psalm 56 and verse 8. When we cry the tears that tribulation and trials bring, remember what David said there? God puts them in a bottle. He saves them. He writes them down in his book. He's able to do exceedingly abundantly above everything that we ask or think. Well, as we think of this, we think of the enormity of our responsibility to him. This is my beloved son. Hear ye him. He has all authority in heaven and on earth. He's the author of eternal salvation. Unto who? Unto all those who obey him. Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and do not the things that I say? We often preach on 2 Peter. In fact, I just preached on it a week or two ago about giving all diligence to add to our faith, virtue, and so forth, because of all of these wonderful things that God has done for us. And in that vein, I can't help but preach on Hebrews 10 and verse 25, not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together. When you look at attending all of the services that we have every week, that takes up less than 2.5% of our week. 2.5%. Why do we gather here? We're gathering here to worship and study about the star breather. Surely we can see the critical importance of that. And I have to give a shout out to Wilma. How much of an example she is to be here and to encourage all of us. As we consider these things, it should bring home the enormity of following his word. In 1 Corinthians 2, verses 1 to 13, Paul talks about inspiration. And in verses 9 and 10, he says, "Eye has not seen nor ear heard, nor have entered into the heart of man the things which God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed them to us through his Spirit." He's revealed what to us? The things that he's prepared for those who love him, for those that love the star breather that spoke the universe into existence from nothing. That same word is going to judge us, John 12 and verse 48. And of course we know that it's not just the red letters words in the Bible, it's the words of the inspired apostles and prophets, because he sent them to guide them into all truth. So let's make this application to our personal lives and to the church. How important is it to follow the words of the star breather? It's absolutely critical. One of my pet peeves is the fact that so many churches, even churches of Christ, instead of, we hit on this in Bible class, instead of focusing in on God, focusing in on increasing our faith and getting the gospel message out, they're all about food, fun, and frolic. Jesus purchased the church with his own blood. How in the world can we then turn that into our own personal playpen rather than what God intended it to be? The Word of God lives and abides forever, and we cannot subtract from it or add to it. Another thing we need to realize is the enormity this all has on rejecting him. The saddest words in the Bible, in my opinion at least, are in Matthew 27 and verse 25, when the Jews said, "His blood be on us and on our children. Crucify him. We don't want anything to do with him." And all you have to do is look at the history of the Jewish people to know they've paid for that over and over again, terribly. So we have an example of what rejecting him is all about, but it's going to be even worse when we look at eternity. As we study from 2 Thessalonians this morning, and he's going to take fiery vengeance on those that know not God and obey not the gospel. In Mark chapter 9, Jesus said that hell was a place where the fire is never quenched and the worm dieth not. And then finally, on a positive note, the enormity of being a joint heir with the star breather. Can you imagine that? When I think of all of the sins I've committed in my life, that God still gives me that opportunity. He's going to give me an immortal and incorruptible body. And for everyone who loves his appearing. 1 John 3 and verse 2, we shall be like him. Imagine that. We'll be conformed to his glorious body, Paul says in Philippians 3 and verse 21. We will be, as he says in Romans 8, joint heirs with the star breather. Now, this is one of those lessons. It's kind of hard to find an ending point. I would encourage you to take this concept of Jesus as the star breather and think about it. As you read your Bible, every time God's word mentions him, think about who he is. He's the star breather. In Job 9, verse 8, it says, he alone spreads out the heavens and treads on the waves of the sea. He made the Bear, Orion, and the Pleiades, and the chambers of the south. Now verse 10 says, he does great things past finding out, yes, wonders without number. We've just barely touched on it here this morning. In Job 26 and verse 14, indeed, these are the mere edges of his ways. And how small a whisper we hear of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand? In Psalm 106 and verse 2, who can utter the mighty acts of the Lord? Who can declare all his praise? Remember, Jesus of Nazareth, that carpenter of Judea, he died a shameful and cruel death as possible for you and me. He is the star breather. In Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 26, about the stars again, he calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power, not one is missing. You know, he numbers the hairs of our head, but he also numbers the stars. We can only see a portion of the universe. He knows it all. And amazingly, the star breather invites you and me to come. Come to me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn of me, for I am gentle and lowly in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. The star breather, the pearl of great price, is calling you today. If you're subject to the call, we bid you come while we stand and sing.
Have you been to Jesus for the cleansing?